Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted. This is your trigger warning. This podcast contains unfiltered conversations about trauma, abuse, and survival. Discretion is advised. This is not therapy or medical advice, just real people sharing real stories. So please take care of yourself and pause if you need to. If this conversation hits home, grab the book Survival Mode Exit Plan, your raw, unapologetic blueprint to break free. Available now by scanning the QR code or clicking the link in the comment. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. It's your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have Holly. Holly, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Holly Dean-Johns, the author of Holly's Hell, 7 Years in a Thai Prison, which is a memoir about my life. From childhood up until now.
Okay. So tell us your story to Survival Mode and through Survival Mode.
Okay. So to give a little rundown of my story, it starts off, I think, in a very normal home, normal childhood, or that type of thing. My parents owned a real estate agency. I'm not sure why that closed down, but that closed, I think, when I was about 10. From there, my parents started running an escort agency out of the family home. So in our lounge room, there were 3 separate phone lines. These phones would ring anywhere from like 6 in the evening until 4, 5, 6 in the morning, depending on how busy the night was. So that was sort of the first time that my family went from what I say was a normal childhood into something else, because I knew that none of my friends had this going on in their house at home. So for that reason, I didn't invite people over, like hardly at all, because how am I going to explain this? When I did have to explain it, I said that my parents ran an import-export business, which would explain why the phones were going at all hours of the night. Yeah, so my father was a very heavy drinker. When he drank, he would quite often get violent with my mother, never in front of us kids, always behind a closed door, but we could always hear what was going on, we knew. You know, my parents ended up splitting up when I was about 12. No, sorry, about 14, I think. And my dad moved back to Melbourne, which was where he was from. All of us kids, there's five kids, we all had the choice of who to go with. We all chose to stay with mum. You know, my reason for not wanting to go with dad was because he was very strict. My mother wasn't. You know, we could get away with anything with mum, but with dad, we couldn't. So that was my reason as a teenager for making that choice. My mother ended up meeting a guy who, at the time, we didn't know he'd been in prison before for drug offences, and he was a heroin addict. We didn't know this. Growing up, we didn't know anybody that used drugs. We didn't know anybody that had been to jail. That side of life just wasn't in our world until my mother met this guy. They both fell in love. And a few months into the relationship, mum found out all of this about him, and she soon started using heroin herself. So that was probably, you know, one of the biggest turning points, I guess, was going from being normal to then going into this different lifestyle that we had never known before. I'd always ask my mum very often, could I try it? You know, could I have a snort? And she'd always say no. Until one night she said yes. And I tried it that first time. And that really was the beginning of the end for me. You know, you hear of stories, you know, like once you've tried heroin once, it's got a hold on you. And that's exactly what happened to me. From that one time, I continued using heroin. At this stage, I was about 15. I continued using it, but as far as my mum knew, I'd only had it that one time. So I became a functioning heroin addict at 15, 16, and nobody knew for a long time. Yeah.
I don't know, that part kind of made me emotional. I've had two relationships with addicts and understanding, like most people, unless they are under the roof or really heavily entwined in an addict's life, has no idea what that looks like. So hearing you say that at 15 you were a functional heroin addict, that breaks my heart, because
Oh,
I
yeah, look.
understand the that cycle of abuse is just, it's horrible.
Oh,
Okay, sorry, I
No,
continue,
that's okay.
Holly.
It's an emotional topic, especially if you've sort of lived that life as well, because you know what I'm talking about. Look, I'll sort of skip on to the next sort of big thing that happened to me. So I met my husband when I was 16. He was also a heroin addict. So our life, you know, just kept going. We were both heroin addicts, both functioning heroin addicts. I ended up getting arrested when I was 20 years old for possession of 10 ounces of heroin. At this time, my husband was in Thailand because he had bought the drugs to give to somebody. We were actually doing these friends a favor. So my husband went to Thailand, brought the heroin, gave it to them. When they came back, I told them I would get the heroin from them because I knew people I could sell a big amount to. They didn't. So the plan was for me to go and do that and bring the money back to them. It really was friends doing a favor for a friend. What ended up happening was they were stopped at the airport once they got back to Australia. They were taken to a hospital for x-rays where they were found to have 5 ounces each in their bodies. It became then a controlled delivery to me. So I went to meet them at the hotel to get the drugs. As I'm leaving the hotel, all these police run out at me. I didn't know until a couple of days later that I had been set up by my so-called friends. When I was in the hotel room, there was a cop hiding in the cupboard with a recording device, recording everything that was being said. So I went to jail when I was 20. I was released when I was 25. When I first got arrested, I got a message to my, well, then boyfriend not to come back to Australia because my lawyer had advised me that if I was doing 5 years, he'd be doing 15 years. So I just said, look, don't come back. So once I got out when I was 25, I had to serve 6 months of work release, which I completed. After that, the justice system didn't have a hold of me anymore. So I immediately got on a plane, went to Thailand to be with my boyfriend. I was flying back home to Australia 2 or 3 times a year just to see my family and my friends. What I ended up doing was I started getting a guy that I knew who made fake identities and stuff. I got him to make me up a calendar, which he would insert 15 grams of heroin in this calendar. To anybody, it just looked like a calendar. So I was getting that sent back home to myself in Australia. So when I did come back, I had heroin to use. Yeah, that's why I was doing that. A guy that we knew in Thailand, he knew what I was doing. He had done a run to Australia with a kilo of heroin. He got busted at Darwin Airport. So the police said to him, "Who are you doing the run for?" And he said, "Me," which was bullshit. Like, he wasn't doing anything for me. But he knew what I was doing with the calendars. So he said to the police, "Look, I'll give you what she's doing now in Thailand." And for that, he got a reduced sentence when he went to court. So I was then put under surveillance by the Thai and Australian police. During this time, my then boyfriend was going to do a run from Thailand to Melbourne with a kilo. He did. He got stopped at the airport in Melbourne and he was arrested. So this all happened, his arrest happened about 2 weeks before mine. So there was a friend of ours also living in Thailand. We both lived in separate residences. He came around one night to pick me up, to take me to the post office because I wanted to post this calendar. So he's waited in the car. I've gone into the post office and posted it, got back in the car, and we went to get something to eat. There was nowhere to park. It was really busy. So I said, look, I'll go out and get the food. You just keep driving around the block and pick me up when I come out. So I'm waiting on the side of the road. He pulls up. I get in the car. As I'm going to pull my door closed, all these men run at the car. So I'm now playing tug of war with my door with this guy. I had no idea they were cops. What I thought was happening was I thought we're getting robbed because you get told all the time, be careful, foreigners get robbed a lot. And that's what I thought was happening. There was nowhere for us to go. We're boxed in. So Bob was taken into one car. I was taken to another. They took me back to my house, searched my house. I had another calendar in one of my drawers, and I had about an ounce of heroin in a speaker stereo. That morning, when I went to put the heroin back in the speaker, one of the bolts was loose, and I thought, I'll fix it when I get home tonight. So now that they're searching my house, I'm now freaking out that they're going to pick up the speaker. The back's going to fall off and an ounce of heroin will fall onto the ground. So I was worried about that and I was worried about another calendar in my drawer. One of the cops searched that drawer and didn't see it. Then another cop came behind him and was searching the same drawer. And I said, oh, your mate's already searched that one. But he kept looking and then he pulled out the calendar and showed it to me. So they now had me for another calendar. They didn't find the ounce of heroin that I had in the speaker. While they were searching my house, I managed to put my hand into my bedside drawer and pull out a bag of jewelry that I had. I put that down the front of my jeans because I knew that if they found that, it would be gone. They'd steal it. So by now, I know I'm going to jail and I know that I'm going to need that jewelry to buy food, you know? So the police took my friend back to his apartment. They found 120 grams there, a gun, and a couple of bottles of methadone that was in the fridge. So we were both taken to the lockup where We stayed for a month. Generally, people only stay there for 2 weeks, but we were held for a month. I have no idea why. They wouldn't tell us. We're both coming off heroin in those cells. We were really, really sick. They wouldn't get us any medical help. They said, well, if you decide to use heroin, this is what happens. So when our embassy came to see us at the lockup, we said, can you organise a doctor for us? And they did. So the doctor prescribed us both medication, which the cops had to give us when we needed it. One night, late one night, I could hear a cop talking to my co-accused next door in the cell. And he was asking, do we want to buy the methadone back? I said, yes, we'll buy it back. So we bought it. And I just said to, Bob, I just said, look, just take little sips of it. Don't drink it to get stoned. Just sip it over the next few days. So we're going to be okay. And that's what we did. Yeah. That was sort of my introduction to, being arrested in Thailand. It was really difficult as well in respect to the language barrier. I didn't speak Thai. The police could only speak very broken English. The women that I was in the cell with, luckily for me, there was two Russian women and an Indonesian woman. They spoke English, which was great. I had somebody to talk with. The Thai women that were in the cell didn't speak English. That was a really hard thing to sort of be stuck with. The language barrier was just horrible. It was really horrible being in a position like that and not being able to understand what's going on around you. Yeah, that was really difficult.
So how old were you at this point?
How old?
Yeah.
29.
Okay.
Yeah. So from, a month later, we were both taken to the main prisons. That was an experience in itself. That was horrific. The first thing that really had a big impact on me was when we were taken into the prison. We were searched. We had to have an internal search done. I was thinking it would be like Australia and it would be a qualified doctor or nurse doing this. It was a prisoner doing these internal searches. I couldn't believe it. So I know how many women have gone in before me. So I know there should be a lot of gloves in the bin. When I walked in and had a look in the bin, there were hardly any gloves. So I knew that she wasn't changing her gloves after each person. So even though I couldn't speak the language, I was motioning to her, take your gloves off and put new ones on, which she did. So that was, I guess, my first sort of wow moment. Like, what the fuck is this place? What is going on here? Yeah, it was just like nothing I could even imagine. Yeah.
I am on mute and I know you see my reaction to what you're saying. Like, my mind is like, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a spin out, to say the least. My next big wow moment, I guess, was when I was taken up to the first floor, and it's just a floor full of cells. The walls come up to about waist high, and then it's all bars. So when you're in one cell, you can actually see through to all the other ones. I've walked into the cell, everybody was sitting down on a wooden floor. There was one TV in the room, which was turned on at this time. I'm looking around for foreign faces. There weren't any. I was the only foreigner in that cell of 120 women. And I said, does anyone here speak English? One Thai lady put up her hand. She said, yeah, I do. She was actually what they call the mother of the room. So that means she's the boss of everything that happens in that room. So she would also decide where I would sleep. When she mentioned this to me, I laughed and I said, what do you mean, where am I going to sleep? There's no room. Like, what are you talking about? You couldn't even see the floor. That's how many women there were in this room. So she's walked up each line and counted how many people were in the line. The line that had the least people, that's where I was going. So she told everybody to lay down on their side. She made everybody, move as much as they could, and I was then told that was my spot. That was 22 centimeters wide. It was crazy. You're sleeping between two people, there's two tiny fans in the ceiling, like tiny, so it wasn't doing much. Felt like it was 50 degrees in that cell. It was so hot. And laying next to people, it was really like your skin was melting into their skin. It was horrible. The girl next to me had a ponytail, so her ponytail was in my face. I was pushing her head all night, like trying to get her hair out of my face. And that's what my first night was. This was like, okay, this is how it's going to be. I knew I was going to be there for 20 plus years. I knew that. And yeah, everything was just shocking to me at this point. There was one toilet in that cell for 120 women, a toilet in the ground. So my first night was pretty shocking, to say the least. Yeah, it was like knowing that I was going to have to live like that for more than 20 years, it was just, yeah, unimaginable, pretty much.
So, how long did you end up staying in prison?
I was over there for 7.5 years. And then I was transferred back to an Australian prison as part of a transfer treaty program where I served another 5 years before getting out on parole. Yeah.
And were you still using during that time?
Yeah. When I first got to the Thai prison, the first thing I wanted to find out was who sold heroin. So I started using. I was using heroin. I was using antidepressants, whatever I could get my hands on. I used for about 10 months. And when you hear that saying that somebody had a light bulb moment, like I really did, I woke up one morning, I was outside sitting on the filthy ground, and I just was sitting there looking around me. I was looking at the other women. I was looking at where I was. I was realizing that this is going to be my life for a very, very, very long time. And I don't want to continue living like numb anymore. Because that's what I was using, just to numb everything and not really have to deal with my situation. And it was in that moment that I made the decision to stop using drugs. And I did right then in that moment, and I've never touched drugs since. Yeah, I just wanted to live my life straight and make the best life that I could for myself in jail, pretty much. And yeah, stopping drugs was had to be a part of that.
So when you were out on parole, you were about 40. And what did life look like trying to build it, rebuild yourself?
Look, I thought I would have a really hard time reintegrating into society after being in jail for 12 and a half years. So I was prepared for that. Astonishingly to me and many other people, I walked out of those prison gates and walked back into life like I'd never been away. I was very fortunate in that respect because a lot of other people don't have that experience. I was lucky. I had good family behind me. I had good friends behind me. And I just wanted a better life for myself. And I knew I would have that now that that drugs wasn't in my life anymore. Look, I got on about life. I thought I was going quite fine. After being out for about 2 years, I started waking up in the morning crying my eyes out. And that freaked me out because that's never happened to me before. Or I'd be driving down the street in my car and just start crying. I didn't want to talk to people. I didn't want to go out of my house. My whole life had changed in that respect, and I didn't know why because that wasn't who I am as a person. So I went to see my doctor, and he laughed. He said, "Holly, look what you've been through in your life. Like, you've got like really bad post-traumatic stress. you've got depression. And he said, anyone in your situation would have these things. And as soon as he said that to me, it clicked because I'd never considered that. And as soon as he said those words, I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. So from that, I went on medication. I did a lot of intense counseling for quite a long time. I got to the point where I thought I was okay and didn't need to be on the medication anymore. So I went back to the doctor. I said, look, I'm fine now. I don't need to be on this medication. How do I come off it safely? And he said, look, Holly, I don't recommend that you come off it. And I said, well, I'm going to. So tell me how I can do it safely. He said, okay. Got off the medication. I thought I was fine, but my friends and family could see something that I couldn't and pretty much said to me one day, you need to go back on your medication. Like, you're a bitch. And I was like, what? And they said, you're not right. Like, this isn't you. I went back to the doctor because my friends and family weren't going to lie to me. So I went back. As soon as I walked through his door, he smiled and he said, I knew you'd be back. And I said, well, I did. And I really thought I was okay. He said, no. So from that experience, I understand that I do need to stay on this medication and I'm fine with that. I'm an advocate for medication, for counseling. Like, I really am. It's immensely helpful if
They
you want it
are,
to be.
yes, they are tools to help you manage your life, right? And like
Yeah.
those experiences that you describe, I mean, even from all the way back to 14, or even before that, like even with the phones ringing in the middle of the night, like you've been through a
Yeah.
lot, you know what I mean? And I know there are people who are very much against medication and all of that stuff, but in order to manage our trauma, sometimes we need tools. We need tools to help us. So,
Oh, for sure.
what are you doing now? Like, you've written a book.
Yeah. So what I'm doing now is I work with an organization here. So what we do is we get clients who have been charged by the police for some offense. It's a voluntary program. If they choose to come and do it with us, it's a 12-week program. They come in and do counseling with a caseworker once a week. At the end of all this, they will get a letter which will go to the judge. So what I do in this role is I'm a peer worker. So because I've had lived experience, I can relate to these guys and women, and that's really helpful for them because they find it really hard to sit down and talk with somebody that hasn't walked the walk or talked the talk. So yeah, our clients are very grateful that I am there and I'm there to assist them. I'm there to support them in whichever role they need. Look, I absolutely love my job. It's a joy to go to work every day. I'm very fortunate in that because I know people that hate going to work every day. So for me to be working and doing something I love is just amazing. Yeah.
You mentioned something really important there. Representation is key, right? I've heard addicts say, I don't want somebody to talk to me from a textbook. I want
Yes.
someone who understands what I'm been through, that daily struggle of that grind of addiction. You don't understand it unless you lived it. And in similar with trauma, right? A lot of people struggle with getting assistance from someone who has not been through the bowels of trauma and having to claw their way back to some sense of life. So representation really, really is important. And like you said, your clients appreciate working alongside someone who actually gets it, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny as well because clients have also said to their caseworkers or whoever, even to me, if I wasn't there to be a part of it for them, they wouldn't be on the program. They wouldn't have stayed. So that speaks volumes. The other things as well, I'm not sure if you're aware of, my mother, my oldest brother, and my younger sister all died from heroin overdoses. So, to me, having lost many family members through this disease, it is just another reason why I'm so happy to be in the role I'm doing. If I can stop that happening to somebody, that's everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Holly, your story has really made me emotional. I don't really have a lot of words, and that's like a first for me, to be honest. But I appreciate you sharing your story and the journey for you. Like, oftentimes, and like one of the reasons why I do this podcast is because there is so much value in sharing our stories. We create community. It allows others who believe that I'm the only one that understands this to recognize that they
Yeah.
are not alone. And yeah, there's so much power in just being able to share and share our journeys. So tell us how we can connect with you online, how we can find your book, all of that jazz.
Yeah, look, the book's sold in so many places. Just type in my name, book, you'll be able to find it. I did audiobooks on Apple, Spotify. I'm on every platform pretty much.
Okay. Before we wrap it up for the day, just give us one key takeaway that the listeners can action.
Oh, that I'm asked that all the time, and it's a really hard question to answer. It really is. Look, I'll give you an example. I've been in jail twice, both for heroin offences, right? Now, most people would say, oh, she'll reoffend again. She's a drug addict. But I was given a chance and I have turned my life around. So, what I would say to people is, look, if you're dealing with somebody that has an addiction, it doesn't matter what it is. Don't write people off after once or twice. Yes, people will stuff up. Do you know what I'm getting at? It's like for me, yeah, I fucked up twice, but I managed to get right. And people have that opportunity. A lot of people won't make it, but a lot will as well. So I just think really read the room, really understand what you're dealing with before you write somebody off that's going through this stuff. It's hard stuff. It's a horrible thing.
As someone who had to learn, I had to educate myself after the experiences that I have been in. I have been with a cocaine addict, and I, at that point, never been around anybody that had used. Like, my uncles were users, but I had never been exposed to that growing up. So there was a lot that I had to learn. Now, my second relationship was with crack addict, and
Yeah.
because I had learned a little bit, I didn't learn a lot, it was easier for me to navigate the room. But I find that most people don't even they don't even care to educate themselves until the
Yeah.
addict is a child or a father
Yeah.
or a mother or whatever, very close to them. And similar with trauma, right? Like, people don't really care unless it hits him. And I think one of the reasons why I think these podcasts are so important, these stories are so important, is because we as a society need to be a lot more compassionate, right? Most people who are
Oh,
using drugs are numbing themselves as a
yes.
result of the trauma that they've been through, a result of the experiences that they've been through. It's not the seeking a high. But that high isn't, I'm doing this so my life is better. They're doing it so that they can deal with the life. And I think that's a
100%.
very important thing to recognize. So, yeah, like, I agree with you there. Like, judgment needs to be put aside. Compassion, understanding is what needs to be the forefront with dealing with anybody, even if you don't understand why they are doing what they're doing. It's a reason behind it. And most people are really numbing themselves. So, Holly, honestly, thank you so much for your time this morning. I I have heard a lot of stories in my processing of this, getting this podcast up and running. I didn't expect to be crying at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. But yeah,
Look, there has been tears, but it's a good story at the end.
yes, it's a good story at the end. You really moved me. Like, your story really moved me, and I hope that it moved the listeners. So thank you again for your time, listeners. Thank you for catching another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. And I want to remind you, you were not built to break. You damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you.